from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been called the world's most famous drawing, and you've seen it even if you don't know what it's called. The bold, nude man in the circle and square, with two sets of outstretched arms and legs, an unforgettable study in geometry, cosmology, humanity, Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. My guest today has unpacked the power and origins of that single image. It's about humanity as key to the universe, man as microcosm, and it's a window into one of history's greatest minds. This hour on Point, Leonardo da Vinci and his Vitruvian Man. You can join the conversation. What does Leonardo's great drawing say to you about man, humans, our place and role in the universe? Is the Vitruvian Man on your coffee mug, your mouse pad? Is he branded on your mind? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll also look at the world's best-known painting, the Mona Lisa, also from Leonardo, and its earliest known copy. But joining me in the studio right now is Toby Lester. His terrific new book is Da Vinci's Ghost, Genius, Obsession, and How Leonardo Created the World in His Own Image. Toby Lester, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much. Hi, Tom.
You've been face-to-face, finger-to-paper with Vitruvian Man. Where was that? I mean, there's only one original copy of this. You write that you can still see the groove in the paper where Leonardo so confidently drew this absolutely iconic image. Describe that meeting of you and this drawing.
Sure. The picture is a single sheet. It's not attached to any of the thousands of pages of notebooks that he's very famous for.
It was started out in one, perhaps.
Possibly.
We
don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. But it now is owned by a gallery in Venice, the Accademia. It's not on public display there. They sort of guard it in the back. But I managed to get permission to go and see it, and I had about an hour with the curator there, and we peered closely at it, and then we held it up to the light, and you can actually see light coming through the pinpricks that his compass made in the circle as he was drawing it. Really a remarkable thing to be able to do.
Describe just the size of that piece of paper that this famous image is on.
I had expected it to be much bigger. It's actually not a whole lot bigger than a normal sheet of printer-sized paper. And the drawing itself is very, very fine. You can see how his stylus really imprinted on the page. And it's a very careful drawing, which suggests he really had a purpose here. It wasn't something that he sort of sketched hastily in his notebooks. A lot of his notebook sketches are very kind of almost furiously done because he's working things out as he draws.
This may be one of the most deliberate drawings in history. I mean, there was so much that he was capturing sort of cosmically and culturally in this one drawing. For those who don't recall it or need a refresher, you can see it at our website, onpointradio.org. But Toby Lester, describe it for us. Give us a little, word tour of this most famous of drawings of the form of man.
Sure. It's a nude male human figure inscribed inside a circle and a square. He's got two sets of arms, two sets of legs.
As if showing his legs straight and showing them spread, his arms directly out to the side and slightly raised. Somebody called this the naked guy doing jumping jacks, as you quote it. And yes, it's got a little of that feeling in it.
But he's got two arms, two legs, which suggests two poses. But actually, if you look at it, one of the things that really strikes me about it, and I think that was very important to Leonardo, was that it's a study of human motion. It's actually 16 different poses, and it's a kind of compressed, almost proto-animation.
Because it could be with arms up and legs together, or right. Arms down and legs apart. You can see all those ways.
Exactly. And then it's surrounded by his characteristic backwards writing. He always wrote from right to left.
Why did he do that? Chinese style, but this was in Italian, Latin.
The most plausible explanation, I think, is that he was a left-handed guy, and he was not educated formally. So he probably taught himself how to write. If you were writing in his day, you used a quill and ink, and in order not to smudge the ink with your palm as you wrote, it would be much easier to lead with the palm, so he pulled from right to left.
There is so much about geometry in this representation of the human form inside the circle and the square. But and it's got that kind of sepia tone to it, I guess, by time and maybe by the original paper. Was it black ink to begin with? Do we know? Or was it always brown? We
I
don't
think
know.
It's likely to have been brown. Brown there are lots of other drawings that are the same.
Part of what makes it so incredibly powerful, though, is the density and explicitness of the head on this body and that great head of hair and that very determined look. Who is that?
Well, the text on the picture tells you that this is a human figure based on the proportions laid out by the Roman architect Vitruvius, and the figure corresponds very closely to those ideal proportions. So at some level, this is an abstract figure designed to show you those proportions. The head, though, is done very, very specifically, much more carefully than the rest of the body, and I can't shake the feeling that I'm looking at somebody specific and possibly even shades of Leonardo himself. It's very hard to know, of course, who he used as model or what he was thinking, but he's looking out at us, and it's that's partly why I called my book Da Vinci's Ghost. I get the sense that Da Vinci's Ghost is staring us in the face right here.
And we in our billions looking back at him or looking back at this image. You describe him, I mean, the descriptions of him from the time suggest it could be him, that he had this a fine-looking man, a strongly built man with this great and carefully tended head of curly curls.
Right, and the few images of Leonardo that survive or at least are believed to represent Leonardo from his own time aren't so different from that. So it's at least, I think, some kind of evocation of himself in the picture.
Certainly in the set of the face. We'll come to the proportions of the body. That's really what it's about. But the fact that this has become a kind of symbol of humanism, maybe it's something in that determined expression of kind of giant, determined ambition in that face that suggests that to us.
Well, I think so. And I think even if it's not a literal self-portrait, it's a kind of metaphorical self-portrait. This is somebody, if you look at that face closely, it's almost like a face peering very carefully at itself in the mirror, trying to understand itself. And that's, in the end, that's what Leonardo was after. That's what a lot of people of his time were after, this kind of sense that if you can really gaze within yourself and understand yourself, then you're going to get kind of a purchase on what everything is all about. And that's certainly what Leonardo felt he was doing in his painting. He wasn't just painting. He was trying to capture and convey the essence of the world.
Maybe you've just put your finger on it, but of all the drawings he's done, of all the drawings that have been done by all the people in all times and places, that this has come to be perhaps the most, not painting, but in drawing terms, maybe the most famous drawing of all. Why do you think that is?
I've puzzled over that a lot, and you know I can't come up with a definitive answer except to say that there's something about Leonardo himself, and there's something about this figure's face. That there are other Vitruvian men out there that precede Leonardo's, which is something that this book is about. He was indebted to other ideas. People like to think of Leonardo as somebody who just sort of appeared and did things that just he pulled right out of the blue. He's indebted to other figures. Those other figures, though, have a very kind of generic quality to them. And this one makes things specific. It makes things very real in a way that I think still 500 years later arrests people.
So we're talking 1490.
That's generally agreed to be the date based on the kind of handwriting he uses, the other drawings that he did at the time, the kinds of ink he was using, and even the interests that he had in other walks of life at that point.
The sort of heart thick of the Renaissance. And I have to say, I think many people always took this drawing as a sort of a thunderclap announcement of the Renaissance. Man as the measure of all things. Humanism as the way of looking at the world. And you both kind of affirm that and raise questions about it. You say, well, this wasn't really a thunderclap. As you say, there's a long legacy of similar drawings to this, and yet there is some turning of human perception. Or maybe we're just superimposing this from 500 years later. Does it look as like a conceptual turning point for humanity in this drawing or not to you?
I actually don't think so much. I mean, there's obviously a kind of perceptual turning point, and as a visual artist, Leonardo was able to do things that people hadn't done prior to him. But the image itself it follows along in a very established tradition of depicting the human form as the kind of center of all things. And in a way, Leonardo, in following that idea, was being quite medieval. And that's one of the things that surprised me but also really interested me as I was doing the book, is that Leonardo is always celebrated as kind of the quintessential Renaissance man who was very forward-looking and visionary and ahead of his time. But he was, in fact, as blind to the future as everybody else, as fallible, and in fact, as derivative. His picture, I've tried to show in the book, couldn't have come about without his being very indebted to a lot of medieval ideas.
And yet, the human, or at least Western human sense of itself, of humanity's sense of itself, was changing at just this time. And somehow he seems to be capturing that change in this portrayal. It is not mystic in this quite the same way that Hildegard's was, or Vitruvius might have. Certainly the Christian interpreters were.
Yeah, I know, and that's, I think, why I ended up being so interested in this picture is because it sort of straddles the divide. Leonardo would go on to do studies of the human body that anatomically were much more accurate and much more revealing, but in this one he's compressing and compacting all sorts of medieval strands of thought and visual imagery at the same time that he's beginning to look forward and imagine that he himself has the potential within himself to see beyond all that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Leonardo da Vinci, and the most famous drawing in history, his outstretched man in the circle and the square, Vitruvian man, symbol of man as embodying the cosmos. Toby Lester is my guest. His new book is Da Vinci's Ghost, Genius Obsession, and How Leonardo Created the World in His Own Image. We'll talk about the origins right back to the name Vitruvian and how that came to be. But Toby Lester, you've got a little bit that you quote in this terrific book from Leonardo's notes. He took notes all the time and like crazy. And about just, you've got a passage here where it sounds like he's frantically scribbling notes, and it begins to convey the hyperactivity of this mind and the ambition of his mind, even as a relatively young man here.
Sure. This passage that I've chosen here is representative of any number of other passages. Leonardo was just constantly seeking information, making notes himself, trying to figure out how he can get at the meaning of everything.
This list blew my mind. This is just Leonardo in just one sort of rush talking about things he ought to figure out and figure out soon.
Right. He's talking about the human anatomy and his project for studying all of the human body, and this is just a little bit of it. Represent whence phlegm is derived. Tears, sneezing, yawning, trembling, the falling sickness, madness, sleep, hunger, sensuality, anger, where it acts on the body, fear likewise, fever, write what the soul is. Illustrate whence comes the sperm, whence the urine, whence the milk, how the nourishment proceeds to distribute itself through the veins, whence comes intoxication, whence the vomit, whence dreams.
And that just on the human body. You've got other passages here where he talks about, you know, he's got to find a way to capture the measurement of Milan and its suburbs and the measurement of the sun and the crossbow of Maestro Gianetto and waterworks and just on and on. I mean, his curiosity was unbelievable.
Sure was. What's most interesting is that in all cases, he sees connections among all of the different things. They're all getting him to first causes. So it doesn't matter really if he's thinking about the design of weapons, which is something that strikes people as odd for the great master artist, painter of the Serene Mona Lisa to be doing. It's because in the study of weaponry, he's studying engineering. He's studying pulleys and levers and hydraulics and pneumatics and all of these things.
Not so different from the rush of human blood or the crook of an elbow or the way the body crouches.
Or how a bird flies. All these things, they all relate. He's trying to figure out how he can understand everything in the world so that he can capture it visually. He was a very visual thinker, and in fact, he thought by visual analogy. One thing leads to another, always.
This is called this famous man in the circle in the square, the Vitruvian man, goes back to the Roman Vitruvius. Introduce us.
Vitruvius was a military engineer and an architect who lived in the first century BC. Seems like he worked under Julius Caesar first, but then under Caesar Augustus, he decided to write the first treatise on architecture ever written. And in it, he taught people how to do everything from mix mortar and build walls to build temples and even find good sites for cities. And in that book, very famously, in the third chapter, he mentioned the fact that you should build buildings according to the proportions of an ideal human being, Moreover, that ideal human being contained within himself, because of course it was male, that contained within itself both the circle and the square. That's the passage that Leonardo is illustrating in his picture.
So he was saying what the human body was the model for ideal proportions or the model of what actually existed in nature. What was he saying? Build on its basis or find it in nature or both?
Well, again, it's all connected. Mm-hmm. But the idea he's expressing in that very passage mm-hmm. was just if you want to build a proper temple that's going to align itself properly with the heavens, mm-hmm. with the design of the cosmos, you have to base the design of your temple on the design of a human body. Every part of the temple should correspond to the proportions of the human body in one respect or another. The human body was understood in ancient Greek and Roman times to be a kind of mirror of the cosmos. So if you can align your temple with the heavens and use the human body to do it, everything's lined up. And in a kind of convoluted way, that means you're gradually going to be able to rule the world.
And it was because it was the human body. I mean, this is not just a simple observation, you know, sort of the universe in a grain of sand. This wasn't a random bit of material. This was the human flesh.
Right. And I mean, at a very simple level, think of the Bible. God makes man in his own image.
But he was Roman Vitruvius, and this was before the Jesus and all those teachings.
But the ancient Greeks and Romans had this idea as well, and I mean, lots of other cultures too. The mm-hmm. human body.
The Hebrews.
It is the image of the perfect and the divine at some level. And then that idea becomes something known as the theory of the microcosm, which travels its way through Jewish and Muslim and Christian religious and even scientific thought right up until Leonardo's time. It was a very powerful engine driving all sorts of thinking. You think about medicine. If you really believe that the human body mirrors the cosmos and not only that corresponds to the constellations and the planets, it sort of alters the way you understand how you're going to try to fix the body.
We think of this as a kind of humanist take on the world, centering it all off the human body, and within that, certainly in Leonardo's great drawing, the intensity of the human intelligence radiating from it. But you quote all the way back, this is in the Dark Ages, so-called, the Isidore of Seville, great encyclopedist of that time, writing in the 7th century, I mean, really in the heart of it, saying, all things are contained in man, and in him exists the nature of all things. How did that view of the world coexist with what we know was the huge emphasis on the divine in that medieval time?
Well, I think in the case of Isidore and in the case of ancient and medieval thinkers, you're not going to be able to get access to the divine directly, but at least you can see a reflection of it in the human body. The undercurrent there is you're not necessarily going to be able to understand it. You can recognize that it's there, and it's a way of contemplating what's greater than you. I think the shift that occurs in the Renaissance is that people start to realize or at least believe that they have within themselves enough of a divine kind of intellect to understand things themselves.
Toby Lester is with us. His terrific new book is Da Vinci's Ghost, and he's looking at the famous Vitruvian man, the two sets of arms, two sets of legs in the circle and the square, and that fierce, bold, determined, maybe Leonardo himself, face and head sitting atop all that. Let's go to our listeners. Griswold, Connecticut, Jake is calling. Hi, Jake. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. What do you know?
I actually use Vitruvian Man as a kind of a symbol to remind me to keep trying new things and to push forward. And so I try to live myself kind of like a Renaissance man and be multifaceted. And I actually have it tattooed to me.
Where, if we may ask, Jake?
I have it on my forearm among a drawing from M.C. Escher, another one that I liked. So, and I also cut the Vitruvian Man out of vinyl, and I make decals. I kind of surround myself by it, I suppose, and just reminds me to keep trying new things.
So it's a strong enough image, it's admired enough that you've tattooed it right into your skin. It is now part of you, and it stands for trying new things. You see something about questing or boldness or progression in this image.
Well, I think Leonardo is this is kind of one of his most iconic drawings, so it just reminds me of him and how he was, and he was always trying to better himself in a lot of different areas. So I kind of try to do the same thing with my life.
Jake, I love it, and keep it up. I mean, Toby, what about this sort of take courage, take heart message that Jake finds and push forward message? Is that something Leonardo would relate to? He was young. He certainly was ambitious.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was relentlessly interested in improving himself. He was not an educated guy formally. He taught himself.
And he was self-conscious about that.
Very
but
self-conscious.
He determined to overcome it through his work.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And early on became convinced that he knew better than a lot of these people who were reading received wisdom out of dusty tomes in the universities.
He would observe directly, he would represent directly and discover through that.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, he's certainly a model for anybody who wants to understand themselves.
Carry on. Jeff in Norfolk, Virginia. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I view the Vitruvian Man as like an acknowledgement of our own shared divinity and a call for a responsibility to pass that on in our own creations.
An acknowledgement of our shared divinity. I love it, Jeff. Let me put that to Toby. What about this? Is this the secular humanist at work in Leonardo? Is it the vigor of the divine in this representation?
Possibly. I mean, he wouldn't probably have put it in those terms. He liked to call the divine nature, and he was constantly after what nature, the architect, he often called nature the architect, had been up to in designing things. And it's certainly, I think, the case that he, in looking at the human body and expressing his interest in understanding the human body, was, in a condensed way, trying to understand the nature of everything.
When he called the divine nature, was that also an attempt to escape the dictates of a particular religious view of things, of the Catholic Church at that time? Was that an artist's liberating description of the divine?
He does it again and again. He does make references to God, but they're few and far between. And at one point he says something like, I'll leave matters of the spirit to friars. I think probably appropriately just said, okay, you know, I'm going to focus on studying what I can study. I'm not going to get public about what I believe. I doubt he was a conventionally religious guy, but he had some kind of sense of a grander purpose in life.
He certainly could represent splendor so amazing that for most of us, it looks like you can see why our caller says it touches the divine or suggests it.
Sure.
Give us some more of the path of the kind of legacy of this kind of representation of man from Vitruvius all the way back as a Roman war engineer through all those centuries up to Leonardo. What other moments of representation did this find?
Well, initially, you don't see any, and it's probably the case that Vitruvius never illustrated his famous man in a circle in a square. But by the time you get into the Middle Ages, you see illustrations in Christian and Muslim and Jewish texts that are clearly the human body as a microcosm, and they're labeled as a microcosm, the body representing more than itself. And sometimes those are Christ, sometimes those are Adam, sometimes they're just a generic finger. Hildegard of Bingen did a glorious illustration, one of her visions, that shows a kind of everyman figure at the center embodying the world, surrounded by a kind of red, fiery Holy Spirit, and then there's the classic bearded God presiding above it all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a figure with outstretched arms in a kind of loose circle and square. It seems like she actually knew Vitruvius. She at points sort of echoes his language. So Vitruvius was alive in the Middle Ages, but he tended to be alive not because monks were interested in ancient architecture, but because they liked to think mystically about some of the geometrical propositions he made.
But if you look at Hildegard's vision here, I mean, she's a mystic and she's devout, and this seems as much crucifix as Vitruvian Man a la Leonardo.
Sure, but you can look at Leonardo's figure and you can't help having the association with Christ on the cross as well. It's a figure that at the time he clearly was riffing on.
And it wasn't only him. I mean, you have other images in here of his contemporaries who nearly were doing similar drawings of man in circle and square.
Man in circle and square. And there's one that has only really recently been brought to light that is almost identical to Leonardo's, may precede it, may have been contemporary with it, and very distinctly takes on the aspect of Christ on the cross.
So do you presume that he would have seen these other drawings, these other representations? I mean, not all of them, clearly. The things didn't get passed around so easily in those days.
At least a couple of them. There's one colleague of his who he spends time with. We know he lodged with. It was an architect named Francesco Di Giorgio Martini.
Mm-hmm.
They worked together. They both thought about architecture together. They lodged together at a certain point. Francesco produced a treatise on architecture that was the first text to directly illustrate Vitruvius, and lo and behold, in it there's a figure of a man in a circle and a square. It's hard to think that Leonardo didn't see that, and maybe even that he thought, I can do a little better than that.
Why do you think then we remember his instead of his friends? It's emblazoned on all of our minds.
The short answer is that it's better. He has captured and compressed so much into that single image that, you know, sort of like Shakespeare or something, it's irreducible to a single function or purpose, and it sort of shimmers with resonances.
Let's go to Michael in Lexington, Kentucky. Michael, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to ask a little background first. I taught computing in the College of Architecture for years,
mm-hmm.
and I gave several lectures on the golden rectangle / golden mean /
mm-hmm.
golden ratio.
Mm-hmm.
You've discussed the circle and the square, and also that the proportions are sort of mystical. And I wondered what the relationship might be between the golden mean, which is about 1.6, and was the considered kind of a magical number. It's what you get when you solve the equation 1 plus x equal 1 over x.
Right.
And if you have a golden rectangle and you take a square out of one end, then you're left with another golden rectangle at the other end, which you can take a square out of, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm wondering what the relationship is between the Da Vinci drawing and the golden mean and
yeah.
how those two interacted.
Toby Lester, we're into ideal ratios here.
It's a tough question to know for sure because Leonardo didn't write anything down saying that he was investing his figure with that kind of symbolism. The Greeks knew it, of course, and because of that, when Vitruvius distilled his own writing on architecture and proportion, he may well have kind of invested what he was writing with that idea. I don't think Leonardo consciously was working out how he could include it in his picture. There are a lot of people today who have found all sorts of things like this in the image, and maybe at some implicit level Leonardo picked up on something that was in Vitruvius that
he would have been aware of golden means. All that would have been part of his training.
Well, he would have been, but he was not a particularly good geometrician. I don't know what the word is. A geometer.
Mm-hmm.
And he was learning, but he doesn't really even try to figure out how to square the circle until a little later in his career. So I don't think at this point in 1490 he would have been very, very carefully lodging these kinds of geometrical propositions into his figure.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Leonardo da Vinci and the most famous drawing in history, his outstretched man in the circle and the square, Vitruvian man, symbol of man as embodying the cosmos. Toby Lester has written about the origins and history of how this drawing came to be and how we came to be so aware of it in his terrific new book, Da Vinci's Ghost, Genius, Obsession, and How Leonardo Created the World in His Own Image. Toby Lester is with me in the studio, and you write, Toby, that Leonardo thought that this design, this ideal human body, conformed to a hidden geometry of the universe. What was he trying to exactly figure out with that? What does he mean when he says man is the model of the world?
That's opening up a big question because he was alluding to this entire tradition of thinking about the human body as a model for lots of things cosmic. At one level, he's thinking about the fact that the world is made up of the four elements, water, air, earth, and fire. Human body has all of the elements in it as well. Blood is the water, air is the breath, flesh and bones are the earth, and then fire is this kind of mysterious source of heat that keeps the body warm. So if you can understand how the body works and also how the body is able to pump things around itself, keep itself warm, manage to produce movement. Leonardo was fascinated with movement, and the idea of movement, capturing movement, was something that he was consistently working on, and it has a kind of philosophical purpose. Motion was life, and if you could understand and capture and represent motion to people, you were doing philosophy. You weren't just doing art. And he believed ultimately that he wasn't just an artist or scientist. He was a natural philosopher.
So what was he trying to figure out then in that? You know, I mean, he clearly wanted to know how things worked. He tried to come up with helicopters and all the rest. But you also say he got himself right in the middle of this sort of big debate over even what the soul is. We heard in his notes earlier, write the soul, figure out the soul.
Right. Well, and he did spend some time trying to figure out, based on a medieval idea of the brain, the exact location of the soul. And if the brain has three ventricles, and medieval theory had it that one of those ventricles was sort of the seat of human reasoning. They called it the common sense. It's where the spirit resided. And Leonardo believed that, at least in his early career, at the time he was doing this drawing, that with enough attention to detail, with enough examination of human proportion, human anatomy, you could get at exactly where the soul arose, and therefore, if you could understand that, you could have a kind of trickle-down effect and understand how all sorts of things then became animated. And I keep coming back to this idea of animation. It's the kind of pun on motion and spirit and even spirituality. That's what he was after.
Did he see himself? He was clearly trying to push forward human knowledge very deliberately, very ambitiously. Did he see himself on some kind of frontier of understanding? We look back now and say, oh, yeah, the Renaissance. Did he have a sense of himself as in the midst of an important period?
I think he did, but I think he, in a way, he wasn't really the kind of Renaissance man that people often think he was. The Renaissance, in its kind of full flowering, was a period of great erudition. People really are rediscovering ancient texts, rediscovering the Latin language, the Greek language. These things were off limits to Leonardo. He was not a formal scholar. He was not very well educated. So a lot of what he was doing was just his own quest, following whatever sources he could find, getting advice from people. And a lot of the advice he got, the texts he consulted, were what today we would call medieval.
Because he didn't have access to the earlier texts that scholars were opening up then, though they were creating an environment. They were creating an intellectual environment that he was clearly hooking into, part of.
But he was mocked as well. He drew this picture when he was in Milan. He was very interested in getting the favor of the Duke of Milan, working for the Duke of Milan. But a lot of the scholars that the Duke surrounded himself with dismissed Leonardo as somebody who just didn't have the chops to be able to talk about things like philosophy and science. You know, just go do your paintings and spout your little verses and stick to that.
Are we right today to take the kind of endorsement of human significance from this drawing that I think many people do? It seems to put the human at the center of the cosmos.
Well, and there are lots of Renaissance writers who make that very claim, and the writers who were making that claim often came from Florence, and Leonardo really developed as an artist and a thinker in Florence. He certainly absorbed that atmosphere and those kinds of ideas, and I think ultimately is making that kind of a statement. I think he would be very surprised, though, that this picture became his most famous drawing. I think he did it. He took a lot of care doing it, then he moved on.
Right. He was young. He did a lot more. Yeah. But this is the one that went into outer space on the spacecraft and all the rest.
Right. Yeah. And it disappeared for hundreds of years. This surprised me greatly when I got into the book. I had assumed he drew it. People, sort of smacked their foreheads with wonder, and it became famous. He drew it. Close friends admired it, and then it disappeared, and really it doesn't surface in the historical record until 1770 or so.
And not into really wide circulation until 1956,
Right. As best I can figure out, the image takes off as a kind of icon of popular culture in 1956 when an art historian named Kenneth Clark published it in a book called The Nude. You can look on Google Books and search the phrase Vitruvian Man, and it just spikes right there. So that's, I think, how it became a popular icon. But very much divorced from its original context.
Tony in Elgin in Quebec. Thanks for calling, Tony. You're on the air with Toby Lester.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I don't want to take you away from the drawing of by Michelangelo. Just a small comment.
Leonardo, let's keep our great...
How he didn't, apparently you said he didn't do much about the golden ratio, the golden mean, etc. But if you look at the painting, The Last Supper, that is done exactly in the proportion of the golden mean. You know, it's 1.618, etc., to one, the side versus the length, versus the height of it.
I assume he never stopped looking for the formula. He never stopped his awareness of what would make things resonate.
Yeah. There's another thing, Madonna, Mona Lisa. The Mona Lisa, her face is supposed to be more or less in the shape of the golden mean. You know, it's exactly so long and so wide.
Tony, our time is short, but I appreciate your call, Toby. I mean, you can there's his work. You can look at it and see him, you know, the master at work over time, looking for those resonant forms.
Sure, and it may well be, particularly by the time he got to do The Last Supper, which he did later than this picture. By then, he had befriended others in Milan who were mathematicians and who were specialists in geometry. By then, he may well have been thinking much more specifically about these kinds of things. There's even speculation, in fact, that he drew Vitruvian Man as a kind of private key to human proportion and other proportions that he could then use as his own key to draw The Last Supper. Fun idea. I don't know really how to assess whether it's true or not, but...
I mean, it is very meticulously drawn with given very particular ratios that trace all the way back to the Roman engineer himself, Vitruvius.
Right.
What do you take from it finally, Toby? Do you feel enhanced? Do you feel greater as a human being looking on this drawing, or do you feel, I don't know, drawn back into the deep centuries of mysticism? Which way?
The mystical side of things doesn't tug at me as much as the Leonardo side of things. This, to me, was a magnificent window through which I could peer back at Leonardo and his own mode of being. The way he constructed a picture always had more than one thing going on, often had many, many things going on. He believed that images were the best way of transmitting ideas, and I think this image just compresses so many different ideas and ways of thinking and aspirations that's why it's so powerful. It contains so much.
500 years later, and we gaze on it, and it is stirring to our souls and our minds even now. Toby Lester, it's a terrific exploration. We're really grateful to you for writing it and talking with us about it today. The new book is Da Vinci's Ghost, Genius, Obsession, and How Leonardo Created the World in His Own Image. Toby Lester, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, more Leonardo. We'll look at the earliest known copy of his Mona Lisa. This is On Point. A big announcement last week in Madrid, a copy of the Mona Lisa at Madrid's Prado Museum was probably painted by one of Leonardo's apprentices at the same time the master was painting the original. Joining me now from London is Matthew Landrus, an art historian at Oxford University and Rhode Island School of Design. He's a leading expert on Leonardo. Matthew Landrus, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello.
What is the evidence that this copy, which has been around for a long time, it is now understood to probably have been painted contemporary with Leonardo's own work of Mona Lisa?
The evidence comes up relatively recently at a conference in mid-January, where the curators at the Prado had discussed the way in which they had understood the process to be the same for making the copy as it had been for making the painting. So the process for the outlines, for the layers of paint, they had been able to determine that by looking at different scanners, scanner information, infrared reflectography, emissionography, and X-radiograph studies, which tell us about the layering at the same sort of places where the original has been done. So that gives us an idea of closer date as opposed to the previous example of 1517 or before from research done in 1996, Recent study has shown that it's more likely to be 1503 to 1506 when the Mona Lisa was painted.
So 1503 to 1506. So we've been talking in this hour about Vitruvian Man. Mona Lisa is dated to a time later than that in Da Vinci's career. And remind us of the circumstances. Who was he painting there and why?
He was painting a noblewoman who was supposedly at the time about to give birth or had already given birth to her third child, and the portrait was supposedly a commission for that particular event. Lisa Girardini was her name.
And why would a colleague, I guess, of Leonardo's be painting the same woman or a copy of his painting in the same period of time?
Right. The reason for the copy is not clear exactly, but it would seem that perhaps, at least I would think anyway, Leonardo had an interest in having a copy for himself, but most likely what people have done in these circumstances is they find out that this painting or a really good painting is being made, and they want a copy for themselves. So it's most likely that someone commissioned it. An extra version.
You know, looking at these two side by side, we call it a copy, but I'm not sure that I would necessarily have recognized that this was a copy of the Mona Lisa. I mean, it's got a different facial expression to my eye, a very, very different representation of the woman. How would you describe the differences?
Right, which opens up another series of questions about its context, of course, and how much did Leonardo help with the work as well. So, for example, if Salai had painted it, as Vasari recommends or has noted, the biographer Giorgio Vasari in the mid-16th century noted that Salai, one of Leonardo's pupils, had painted for him, and Leonardo would touch up the paintings for Salai. So the different expression and different look of the sitter has a lot to do with which assistant was working on it and what they wanted to add to it. What did Leonardo add to it, if anything, is another question.
A copy, I mean, to me, it hardly looks like the same woman. Or if it is, she's got a very different expression on her face. By the, the demands of that time, would they have tried to get something that would be like a, you know, photocopy, or would there be freedom for reinterpretation in a copy?
It would not have been a photocopy in the way that we look at those today, because these were considered to be alternate sculptures. They were considered to be three-dimensional objects on a two-dimensional plane. So in that way, they were all to be unique, even if they were studio copies or not in the hand of the major master of the studio. So a different approach to the copy could have also been the result of the recommendation or the request of someone commissioning it. They may not have wanted the sitter to smile as much, for example.
That's interesting. Our listeners, you can see the original and the copy of the Mona Lisa side by side at our website, onpointradio.org. Is it possible, Matthew Landris, that the painter of the copy simply didn't have the same subtlety or capacity as Leonardo to create that famously subtle and nuanced expression on the face? They just didn't have the capacity for it.
Absolutely. I think that's it. The background of the painting is more interesting to me anyway. And of course, what we think of when we look at the Mona Lisa is how the drapery and how the lights and darks, the shadows correspond with the lights and darks in the background, and she is then one with nature in a way. And Leonardo, with regard to his other studio processes and studio works that his students had done, such as the Madonna with the yarn winder paintings that are now in two versions, one in New York and one in the Baclou collection in Scotland, those are good examples of his interests in the landscape particularly. Even though one would think, well, the master would want to touch up the hands and the face and the jewelry, just as Guido Reni did in the early 17th century. But not necessarily Leonardo. This is he was very much interested in the background as well.
We've got a listener looking at both and saying Leonardo's version is much more secretive and seductive. The other's more innocent and open. the Prado will put the copy on display middle of this month, and then what? People will be able to see them in the same gallery in the Louvre in Paris later this year, Matthew?
Yes, it appears so, yes.
So for the first time in 500 years, those two Mona Lisas back in the same space. If you happen to be in Paris, you can see them side by side. Any question which you would hang in your living room if you had the option, Matthew Landris?
Any question of which one? Certainly that the one that the Louvre owns, as opposed to the Louvre actually has one of the copies of the Mona Lisa. There are 9 very good copies,
mm-hmm.
and one of the more famous ones has been, at least before the Prado version had been cleaned more recently, had been one owned by Joshua Reynolds, Sir Joshua Reynolds of the of British aesthetics fame, and as an aesthetician, he owned one of the better copies, and it proportionally is accurate. There is a good study of it in the Apollo in 2007. So there's a lot of interest in these copies now.
Nothing like the original to my eye anyway. Matthew Landris in London at Oxford University in the Rhode Island School of Design. Thanks for joining us. And listeners, same to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.